This episode and all of our South by Southwest coverage is brought to you by Vimeo, the new home for 360 video.
Hi, everybody. This is John Fusco, and you're listening to the No Film School podcast. Chances are, you know John Carroll Lynch's face, even if you don't know his name. The actor, who's perhaps best known for his role as the Zodiac Killer in David Fincher's Zodiac, has a staggering 110 acting credits to his name. At this year's South by Southwest, Lynch finally added another role to his resume, director. His debut feature, Lucky, stars the legendary Harry Dean Stanton, another actor who's no slouch when it comes to having a prolific acting career. In fact, the 90-year-old vet has amassed 199 acting credits to his name throughout his career. The film is a character study of an elderly yet spirited atheist living in small-town Texas. Lucky must come to terms with the fact that he may be in the midst of his last few years of life. Lynch has worked with some of the best directors of our age, a list that includes everyone from Fincher to Scorsese to Clint Eastwood. We talk the techniques he brought with him from his favorites of the bunch, the transition from actor to director, and what it's like directing David Lynch. Enjoy. Hey everybody, I'm here with John Carroll Lynch, director of Lucky, a great movie I saw earlier this weekend. I think I'm going to start out, we were just talking, you have such a prolific career and huge resume as an actor. Why did it take so long for you to make this jump into directing?
For a long time, I started in the theater and then moved to film, so I didn't really feel qualified to even consider directing for a long while. And slowly over the course of time, I started to want to, and then you have to figure out how, you know, because it's a full career, obviously. There's essentially two ways that most people get to direct. Anybody really, but you create your own material that you figure out a way to get financed and you do it that way. Or you're on the third year of a television show and you kind of leverage yourself in by just pestering them to death until they finally say fine. And they give you an episode and you do a really good job and then you kind of move on from there. And while I've had a ridiculously bountiful television career, I've never been on the third season of a television show. I've either started on third seasons of television shows, but I've never actually gone through 1, 2, 3 and, you know, dropped the seed and seen in the first season and the second season, and maybe I could follow some people, and then third season, what do you think? Come on, how about the back order? Let's do something. And I've written things and very proud of the co-writing I've done with my writing partner, terrific things, but we haven't gotten a script that's like the right business model for your first feature. You know, we always seem to end up writing things that are more expansive.
Can I ask you what that sort of script looks like? The pinnacle first.
Lucky is a perfect one. It's contained in terms of. Lucky isn't a perfect one, but you know that you can do it in a short period of time. A great example, this is an example that's a brilliant film and a brilliant performance, is Sling Blade. It's containable. You know what the number's going to be. And in the case of Billy Bob, he also had, you know, he knew what the part was going to be. He knew he wanted to play it. And he knew he could get friends to fill in, like John Ritter Robert Duvall, you know, to make sure he could get the financing, and he keeps the number low, right? Mm-hmm. You got to keep the number low, and that's how you do it. That's how you do it.
So then, how did you get attached to this project?
Well, it started through my acting. Drago Samanjo is a friend, and I knew Logan too. They're the co-writers of the piece, and. I was in L.A. in 2015, briefly. We had moved, my wife and I had moved to New York. And I was in L.A. briefly, and Drago said, hey, can I meet you for coffee? So he comes over, and he gives me this script, and he said, listen, Harry Dean's going to make this movie we've written, and, we've got Ed Begley's going to be in it, and we're asking him to direct the movie, and wanted to know if you would want to play Joe. And I read it, and I thought the script was great. And 4 days with Harry Dean, sure, I'd be happy to do that. You know, I said, sure, yeah, man, attach my name. If it helps you at all, I'm happy. If you can find $5, great, good for you. And then about 8 weeks later, I was in Atlanta. I was working on The Founder. And they called me, Drago called me and said, you know, I know you've wanted to direct for a while, and Ed's really busy with Better Call Saul and with the environmental stuff. And, you know, we just wonder, maybe if we asked him if it was cool, you know, with him. So they called him and said, you know, is it cool with you? And he said, listen, I want to do it, but I can't focus on it. And so they called me, and I said, okay. And in a laundromat in Atlanta, we had a conference call and waited for my clothes to dry. And I said, this is the story of the movie that I think you wrote. And you tell me if I'm wrong. And they said, no, that's it. And I said, okay, well, I'd like to, you know, walk through the movie with you over the course of a couple of sessions, you know, a few weeks after this movie's over. So through the fall, we kind of walked through the script and made changes and kind of added some elements and, you know, and turned some other elements. And we started going out to other casts that we thought might be available for financing and, you know, stuff like that. And, you know, friends that might come aboard and play along with David and Ed, who was going to be in the movie, and Harry Dean. And then we got a budget, and it's a focusing thing. I mean, I've said this, it's a focusing thing when your lead is 89. You know, you really get to go to people and say, hey, we need a quick no. It's no's good, but we need it right away. And we didn't get a lot of them, frankly.
So what was it like working with an 89-year-old lead as far as directing? And, I mean, he's an amazing established actor in himself. Like, what did you have to do to get that sort of, I mean, just his face, you know?
Well, it's funny. Everybody's like, man, that face is
It is.
It's incredible. And he brings so much of that with him, obviously. I mean, his life experience is extraordinary. His work experience, 236 films. You know, it's not like he doesn't know his way around the block. One of the things I loved about Harry, whenever you change the angle, wherever it was, if he wanted a prop in frame, he knew exactly where the frame line was. He never asked the question. He just, where does the cigarette lighter need to be? It'll be there. It's just a tiny example of the things he's just forgotten he knows.
Yeah.
The movie is written with his life as the basis of the fictional material. It's very personal material to him. And his ownership of that material was a unique building block, right? So when you're talking about somebody who's going to act portions of their life in a fictional circumstance, it's a different relationship to someone who's even playing a real person. You know, let's imagine that, you know, one is directing somebody who is playing, you know, Albert Einstein. Well, that person is dealing with all the accoutrement of Albert Einstein, our understanding of Albert Einstein and the actual Albert Einstein and how those things dance and mix together. Mm-hmm. You're having that conversation. In this movie, we're like, okay, you're not, I know this story is from your actual life. I know you lived this, but Lucky is saying it.
Yeah, yeah.
And what does that mean at this moment in this story that we're telling with the building blocks of your life?
Huh.
It was a really complicated conversation to have.
Yeah.
And I say conversation, and that's not what you do with Harry Dean. You know, he's not that kind of person. He doesn't block it. He doesn't approach it with frontal lobes at all. I mean, he's a beer, you know, and that's what his gift is. And so there were a lot of times where we had to kind of get into a shorthand of where we were in Lucky's story for the part of his life that we were using to what it was doing at that moment.
Right.
And so we got to a kind of a shorthand. you know, what was Lucky like before the fall, what was Lucky like after the fall, and then what happens to Lucky after he hears Fred's story, you know? And those were the kind of three pieces of the movie. And, you know, three-act structure, essentially. Yeah. And so that was what we came down to. There were a lot of moments where he's personally attached to something. And I, of course, went with it. I mean, I would do that with almost any actor in any circumstance. But in this one, it was vital to do. Mm-hmm. Because he was revealing himself in a really vulnerable way.
So how did... I mean, this is probably a question better suited to the writers, but this whole thing is so... It's such an interesting thing to start writing as far as making a movie about Harry Dean's... Like, how did they have that sort of relationship with Harry Dean?
Well, I mean, I can speak of the stories I've heard, and maybe you'll get a chance to talk to Logan. I know he's here somewhere.
Yeah.
Logan's known Harry for a long time, and... At times, Logan's an actor and a producer and a writer, and at times when Harry's needed him and he's been free, he's worked for Harry. But he would go over to Harry's house whether or not he was working with him. You know, it didn't matter. You know, I don't think that's their relationship at all.
Yeah.
And he loves Harry, and Drago's known Harry for a long time, and he admires him deeply, and they were talking, and like. I think Logan, this is the story I heard, Logan said, you know, I want to work with Harry. Mm. You know, and they started talking about this idea they're going to write him a movie. And I think for a long time, Harry was like, whatever, you guys, you're not going to do it. Then they started writing it. And then they started talking to him about it and what was going to happen in it and how they were going to use the stories. And he was like, okay, it's never going to happen. And slowly over the course of time, you know, they willed it into being, and they attached me, and they got the other actors involved, and then we started getting, you know, the band, you know, the crew of people that are needed to make the movie started coming on board, and slowly Harry started to realize, oh, we really are going to do this thing. And then it started to become real for him, which makes perfect sense to me, because I mean, if you're fortunate enough to work and, you know, fortunate enough to have people who care about your work and want to see more of you, they're going to go, I'm writing this thing for you. And you go, great, thanks, man. And then you don't hear from them because it's really hard to get it done.
Yeah.
And so you just stop believing them. You know, you kind of protect yourself. Mm-hmm. And with this particularly, when it's your stories and it's your world.
Yeah.
I mean, he has a documentary called Partly Fiction.
Okay.
Which I watched preparing for the movie, and it was so great to see these documentary scenes with David and Harry sitting on David's couch drinking coffee and David asking Harry questions. It's fantastic. And I guess this is kind of the partly fact of that. I mean, it's the flip side of that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Because it's a narrative too, so.
Yeah, it's a narrative, and it has a narrative. Yeah. It's an interior journey, but it's a narrative. Mm-hmm. And that was the thing that was the challenge, mm-hmm. is to take these stories and to take this thing and to put it into a narrative that reflects the essential experience that they feel, those writers feel, that Harry has had in his life. Mm-hmm. And that's really challenging.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's also challenging without, you know, getting into the space of manipulation or sort of overly nostalgic feeling where, you know, it's looking back at something, because it felt like it was like a slice of the present, you know? I mean, he has such a way of just being there, mm-hmm. and having those events unfold like right before your eyes and seeing, no matter how much history is behind him, like who he was in that moment. And I think that was, I mean, it was such a brilliant character study in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I know that for me, I wasn't interested in, Harry is never interested in the past.
Mm-hmm.
He tells these stories as present events that are still he's working on.
Wow.
And for him, I think this journey, again, I'm speaking for him, but it's likely I'm speaking for him because, well, he's not here, first of all. I mean, he's 90 and he's like, I'm not,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, he just, you know, he's done the movie and I'm sure at some point we'll, there'll be interviews like this, but Harry didn't like to talk about this stuff.
Hmm.
Anyway, I think for him, it was all about a question of getting to a point where he gets the moment where that feeling he's gotten of peace around being that he tells everybody with the simple phrase like "you're nothing."
Mm-hmm.
The first thing that Lucky says in the movie is "you're nothing." He turns to Joe and says "you're nothing," and then Joe turns back "you're nothing."
Mm-hmm.
That's a call and response he does with the valet at Ago's, you know.
Yeah,
and he believes it. We're all nothing, and we're all nothing. And that's okay with him. Mm. He's 100% okay with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Life happens in 360 degrees. And now, on Vimeo.com, so do your videos. Now you can upload, watch, and even sell your 360 videos on Vimeo. Vimeo 360 means immersive eye candy, immersive adventures, and immersive storytelling from the world's best filmmakers. Plus, Vimeo has tons of helpful resources for all experience levels. You can learn how to shoot, how to edit, and even get roundups of the best 360 video gear. Join the new home for 360 video at vimeo.com/360.
You know, going back to the fact that this is your first feature as a director, I mean, it's also crazy to me that you didn't write it because it just feels like such a deeply personal and like unique sort of vision. You having acted in so many films yourself and worked with so many different directors, was there anything that you had like kept in mind from favorite directors that you had learned from experience on how to work with actors or how to work just in general?
Well, I knew how directors I'd worked with were effective with me. Mm-hmm. And I'd seen the adaptation of effectiveness with others. Mm. And I have a vocabulary for myself that works. And one of the things you have to do as a director, this part I wasn't worried about at all, was adapting the vocabulary for the actor you're working with. I'm going to put it in musical terms because it's just kind of simpler.
Yeah.
If you're trying to arrange a combo, you're not going to talk to the piano player the same way you talk to the violinist.
Mm-hmm.
And music is far more notated, far more universally notated than acting ever will be.
Mm.
So the uniqueness of the instrumentation that you bring to a movie or bring to a scene or bring to a play is eclectic and unique, mm-hmm. in a way that, you know, it's eclectic and unique with every player of every instrument, but the notations are generally the same. You can talk about quarter and eighth notes, you can talk about keys, you can talk about, you know, bridges, you can talk about, you know, all the things you can talk about, tempo. Mm. With acting, you can talk about those things, but it's not necessarily universal. So each individual person you're working with as an actor or as a director has their own vocabulary for what they do.
Right.
And it's either self-taught or it's structural from a school.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fortunate as an actor to come up through working. I mean, I find myself fortunate in it. I work with a lot of people who came through really definitive schools of acting, and they're great. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just I was happy that I was asked to be malleable in the process of the work, which has helped me a lot.
So how do you identify those sort of characteristics? Would you say it's just from experience, or those like
improv?
Huh.
I mean, you know, you just listen and talk and you see what works, and you you know, you find turns of phrase, you find moments. I mean, Gene Hackman was famous for saying to directors, I want to hear four things: faster, slower, louder, softer.
Huh.
That's it.
Yeah.
And that worked for him.
Yeah.
I mean, the body of work is extraordinary.
Yeah, absolutely.
Some actors don't want to hear from directors at all, and you have to figure out a way to direct them without talking to them. And, you know, Harry's working with Harry Dean was a challenge because he's a master artist. Mm-hmm. And so you've got to bring it.
Well, you
and he can smell it when you're not.
Yeah. I mean, you were working with a master artist and you're working with like one of the greatest auteurs of our time
as an actor
too, David Lynch.
Yeah.
So what was it like directing Lynch?
Well, David was, I was very busy that day. Busy those days, but so I didn't have time to be too intimidated, but I was thrilled that he came. But David, I think, came to play as the actor he wants to work with, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So he came prepared. He was adaptable.
Mm-hmm.
He had ideas and strong opinions about certain things, but he accepted the dialogue. I mean, I'm talking about in between personal dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And he also brings his lifetime of directing to his acting, because he knows how the camera's going to, he knows what the shot is.
You know, it's almost like, talking about this, it's almost like you're doing the exact reverse
opposite
of each other.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you have so much experience in acting that you're becoming the director that you've always wanted to act for, and he's the...
I don't want to presume that I have anything at all to do with David Lynch's journey.
Sure.
But I think that the analogy is not inaccurate.
Yeah.
You know, he's acted a few times. Certainly he's acted more than I've directed.
Mm.
He was the actor. I think he came as the actor he wants to direct. Yeah. And he did a hell of a job, obviously. I'm so impressed with what he did in the movie. But also there was a moment where Harry was struggling with this one run of lines. When I forget things, when I can't remember them, it's likely because I'm not attacking them the right way. It's likely because I'm not playing them the way they should be played. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand why they're there.
Right.
And that was happening with Harry. And with the volume of work, he was getting frustrated with this one beat, because we'd get there and he couldn't turn the corner to
it.
And he's like, what the fuck am I saying this for? Why am I even fucking turning this person? What is this here for?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, this is kind of what I think it's here for, Harry. I think you're talking about this, and I think this is the reason why you turn to that person and ask him that question. And I think that's the response. You're trying to find some salve for what you're feeling. And he's like, yeah. And he did what I've done 1,000 times, is you try to play the politics of it. You turn to the other actor you're working with, you know,
mm-hmm.
and you turn to the other actor and go, do you understand this?
Yeah.
So he turns to David, do you understand this? And David goes, yes, I do, Harry. And he goes, well, what the fuck is it then? And David turned to me and looked at me, and I said, jump on in, feel free.
Cool.
And he was like, turned back to Harry, and he goes, it's not my place to say, Harry.
That is an amazing
And I
story.
Thought, that's the actor he wants to play. He wants to be when he wants actors to do that, which is shut up and let me direct this thing.
Huh.
Don't muddy the water. Let it be between me and that other actor. Don't get involved.
Interesting.
And I loved that. It was said so serenely and with such love and care. And it was perfect.
Yeah.
It was a perfect response. And so we did it. Now, the funny thing about it is, Harry was right. It's not in the movie. We cut the beat.
Hmm.
He was right.
Yeah.
We didn't need it.
Yeah. Did, you know, because I come from actually a theatrical background myself. I've talked with so many directors that stress the various importance of different aspects of production.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it seems like your background in theater, as far as really breaking down, you know, like your character's objectives, whatever, talking mm-hmm. with the actors about those sort of things mm-hmm. is paramount.
Yeah. Some actors play that way, and certainly that's the way I was taught, and that's the way I still work. Some actors respond to that, and some actors don't, depending on how they learned.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to go. Each director has to go to where that actor lives,
mm-hmm.
and can't get you're doing yourself a disservice as a director if you think you're going to change the actor's process to fit you.
Right.
I believe. So you have to find a way to bring out what you feel the scene needs from their point of view, you know, from where they play.
Mm-hmm.
And so it helps you, certainly helps you, and it's certainly the way I think about it. But it's not universal, and you really have to come at it. Like, say somebody comes out of a sketch background, you know, or a brilliant actor. He's so terrific, and he came out of clowning, and I'm thinking of he's on Legion right now.
Is it the Dan Stevens, the lead?
No, not Dan Stevens.
Bill Irwin.
Bill Irwin.
Yeah.
Bill Irwin learned as a clown, okay? Clowning, it has a centuries-old tradition that breaks down scripts and breaks down scenes in completely different ways than Stanislavski ever imagined to do it. Do you just simply throw that away? Simply throw that away, the centuries, and simply throw away a master artist's experience because it doesn't fit your conception of what it should be like? That seems dogmatic in a way that's unreasonable.
Right.
And counterproductive.
Yeah.
Harry Dean went to school for acting. He's acted for 1956, so he's acted for, you know.
He's been in the game for 50 years.
Been in the
more
game
than
for 60 years.
Yeah, 60 years.
So I imagine that by this time, you know, he just plays the chords, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Eric Clapton doesn't think to himself C to G anymore. You know, he just does it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way Harry does it.
Great. Well, I guess I have time for one more question. Probably I don't want to keep these others waiting. And it's a question that I ask a lot of our guests, but for you it seems particularly apt because it's, you know, you've been here for so long, and it took you a while to get to this point, but do you have any advice for any like first time directors, or what is your best piece of advice for people who are really looking to like make that?
You know,
that
I had great help from friends who have been in the directing chair for a while, and I sought them out, and they were generous to me. And I've been talking with DPs and directors before this about the process, and observing and watching directors direct for years. But I would say the primary things I learned from every director I admire is, you know, be prepared. I mean, do the homework that's necessary for you to be really clear. And then the other thing is that understand that it's not, you're not there to prove your preparation. You're there to get what you need. Mm. And be clear about what it is you need from every moment in every scene. And that would be, I would say, the primary pieces of, because the places that I, and also understand that you're likely wrong. So have a plan B. And if you can think of a plan C, have a plan C.
It's all preparation.
Yeah, it is.
And it just seems like you come from this with such an actor's standpoint of just being.
Well, you can't. You bring what you know, right? So, one of my favorite directors I've ever worked with is an editor, and he brought all of that with him.
Yeah.
He started as an editor, and you could feel it when he knew what he needed, and it was great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great, man. Well,
thank you
so much.
Yeah. Nice talking to you.
There. Thanks for listening. If you liked what you heard, go to whatever podcast platform you use. Go subscribe to us. I guarantee you were on it. If you do primarily use iTunes, it would really help us out if you go give us a 5-star rating, and it will help us continue coming out with some great interviews over the course of the next year. Stay tuned this Thursday for another episode of Indie Film Weekly, where we will be talking about some of our best experiences at this year's Tribeca Film Festival. I'm John Fusco. You can follow me at Jim_John_Jim on Twitter. You can follow No Film School at No Film School. And until Thursday, take it easy.